I thought I would start by telling you where to find, if you haven't already found it, the webpage for the course. This is my webpage, which has got lots of fun stuff on it, including links to a whole lot of medieval recipes and poetry and books and articles. But it's just daviddfriedman.com is easy to remember. Middle initial is D. And this is the, oopsie, why did it just went, it just did something. I don't know what, here we are. Let's go back to here. This is what it looks like up at the top. However, I put in a link to the class webpage so that people could find it. Here is the link to the class webpage. And the class webpage now has on it the PowerPoints for all five, link to the web draft of the book, podcasts of most of the book that someone else is doing, recordings of first half of the first class, because I forgot to turn it on again after the break, all of the second class and all of the third class, and none of the fourth class, because I forgot to turn it on at all. But I have turned it on this time, so I expect I will put up a recording of this. Whether that'll be useful to you, I don't know, but since the cost of doing it is very low to me, I tend to try to put that sort of stuff up. All right, any questions on that before I shut that down and start what we're actually doing today? No. All right. Close tabs. And this is the PowerPoint. And it is not working right because I haven't yet told it that I want to do this through presenter mode. Presenter view. And let's see if presenter view is right or if I have to switch it just a minute. It's right. So I'm seeing both this slide and the next slide, and you are seeing just this slide, which is the way presenter mode is supposed to work on PowerPoints when I don't get it wrong. All right, so before I start on the new stuff, the subjects we covered last week were England in the 18th century, Athenian law, and the general issue of ways of enforcing rules, which we'll be picking up again some on today. Any questions on that material that you have? No. All right, let's keep going then. Subjects for today are the problem of error, the fact that when you're enforcing laws, you sometimes convict the wrong guy, different mechanisms for making law, the problem, which hopefully most of us, as well as ancient people, are available of who will guard the guardians, given that somebody's enforcing the law, how do you enforce the law against them? And then finally, as sort of my final chapter in the book, ideas from these societies that we might want to use for our own legal system or for other purposes. All right. Let me start with the problem of error. And this is linked to the problem of the incentive to enforce, that rules require some incentive to enforce. There's got to be some reason why somebody hunts down the criminal, proves that he's the criminal, whatever. And otherwise, they won't get enforced. The problem is that we cannot readily distinguish between enforcing a rule and convicting somebody who is innocent. That is to say, you normally measure the outcome by its success in getting people in whatever, whether it's suing people or trying them or for criminal things. So we have two problems if there's too strong an incentive to enforce. One problem is just that we may spend more resources enforcing rules than it's worth. If you imagine if we really took seriously littering rules on the highway, this would require, a person every 200 feet watching to see if anybody threw a bag out of his car. Clearly not worth doing. So we have some kind of a trade-off between enforcing imperfectly and spending all of our resources trying to enforce. But the more interesting puzzle is that if you have a strong incentive to convict, which is the way you would normally measure the enforcement, that will give you an incentive to convict innocent people as well as guilty people. You might do it directly. You might know they're innocent, but figure you'll benefit by it. If you imagine a tort lawsuit, say, where you in fact know the person you're suing did not act wrongfully, but you hope you can persuade the court that he did and collect lots of damages. But you might also have it simply because you're trying to convict the guilty, but the ways that make it easier to convict the guilty also make it easier to convict the innocent. If you say, all right, we're going to lower our standard of proof. If you're probably guilty, we'll convict you. That's going to get more people who are innocent than if you say only if we're absolutely certain. Then we'll be coming back to some historical examples and modern examples of the tension that raises. Right. We try to prevent this by having legal rules that we hope will let us separate the innocent from the guilty. But it's not clear how that works. If we think about our legal system now, one of the things that may occur to us is we have very elaborate rules for jury trials, and those rules are presumably designed to make sure that only if we're really sure you're guilty you get convicted. But in fact, almost nobody gets a jury trial. The overwhelming majority of all felony convictions are by plea bargains, and this raises the question, the critical question to which we don't have a good answer, of what is the rate of false positives in the criminal justice system. False positive means concluding that something is true when it's false. In statistics, we distinguish between the problem of the mistake that consists of failing to determine that something is true when it is, and the false positive, which is concluding it's true when it isn't true. And if you think about criminal law from that standpoint, you can see that the false positive is the innocent person convicted. And we'd like to know how common that is. And nobody knows. That's an unfortunate fact. I got into this, as I may have mentioned before, when I was at University of Chicago Law School. I and Steve Schulhofer wrote an article proposing a voucher system for indigent felony defendants. Because at present, if you are a poor person accused of a felony, you have a right to a government-appointed lawyer. But that means that in a large majority of all felony trials, both lawyers are working for the same employer. They're both working for, directly or indirectly, the government that's prosecuting you. Remember, all criminal cases are government versus the person. It's always the state of California versus or the U.S. government, federal government versus. So that was disturbing, and it suggested that if you're going to make a certain amount of money available, you should give the defendant the option of choosing his own lawyer with that money. And one of the things we got into then was discussions about whether this was a problem, whether you did, as a result of having a system where the lawyer didn't really represent the defendant, you ended up with a lot of people who were innocent getting convicted, and there were disagreements about whether that was a problem. And that got me thinking about how would you know. And one approach, you know.
Just out of curiosity, is there a big difference between what a prosecutor is paid and what a public defender is paid?
I suspect that's going to depend on the state, because it's all at state level. And the defender, there are a bunch of different mechanisms. There are some places where you have a public defender's office. And there are other states where the judge, in effect, assigns a private lawyer to do it on various terms. And there were, back when we were doing this quite a while ago, there were some scandals where it looked as though lawyers were getting assigned by judges to whose election campaign they contributed money. And that suggested that the being assigned in those particular states was actually a plus. And you say, but they aren't paid very much. And the answer is yes, but they can always do less work than that. Since, after all, they are not being chosen by the person who's supposedly their client.
What about people that plead guilty, but they're innocent, and they do it to avoid they being threatened?
Yeah, that's the plea bargain problem, which I already mentioned. Yeah, but that would be a false positive, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's probably most of the false positives, since most convictions happen that way. I think well over 90% of all felony convictions are plea bargains.
How long is the false positive plea bargain the major practice?
I don't know. Certainly for decades, but I'm not sure. Probably not as much as a century, but I don't know. I haven't been studying the American legal system. That's not a legal system different than ours. Just trying to apply these, I do it. So one possibility that it occurred to me, if you wanted to try to estimate it, was to take advantage of a new technology. So you can say, all right, here are people who were convicted before we had DNA testing. Let's go back and do DNA testing. And there have been various innocence projects, one of them actually at Santa Clara University, though that was one of the later ones, which have tried to do that and have certainly found some cases of people who on the DNA evidence looks as though they're innocent. But it's tricky because it's those are going to be cases where there's enough evidence for innocence. So the Innocent Project said, aha, we suspect he's innocent, let's push to do this. So that's not a random sample. And what I wanted to get someone interested in doing, but I never succeeded, was getting some friendly jurisdiction that would let you take all convicted felony defendants or a random sample of convicted felony defendants and do a DNA test. And I tried to get somebody associated with our Innocence Project interested, and she wasn't interested. And I'm afraid that that reason might be that she thought the result would be that there weren't very many false positives, and that would make it harder to pursue those that are. But in any case, it didn't happen. But there have been a number of attempts short of that. There was one, I think, in Virginia where it turned out that by accident a whole bunch of DNA had been preserved. And then there was somebody else who looked at rape murder cases because they were ones that were particularly likely to have DNA. And those figures suggest a false positive rate of a few percent. But those are that's very, very uncertain because nobody, I think, has done anything like an adequate job. And in particular, the second one I was describing, assumed that all dubious cases would by now have been retested. They weren't doing the retesting themselves, and I think that's probably not the case. But in any case, so that is a possible approach. And they suggest a few percent, but I wouldn't be astonished if it was actually a good deal higher than that, given our present system. I just don't know, nor does anybody else. All right. We then get into a particular case, and this is really the medieval and Renaissance law of torture, which is a very interesting article on. And the original medieval solution to the problem of not convicting the innocent was let God decide. So you say, all right, you claim you're innocent. In that case, we will put you through the following ordeal. We'll tie you up and dump you into water, and if you sink, that means that you are innocent, and we'll pull you out and let you go. If you float, that means the water rejected you because you're guilty, and so we'll pull you out and then punish you for the crime you've committed, essentially. And there were a variety of other ordeals. That's one of them. And the theory is God is omniscient, so he will arrange it. Not an unreasonable theory. However, eventually the church decided that it was not legitimate, that telling God you've got to give us an answer is not something humans are supposed to do. And so the Catholic Church essentially shut down the ordeal system. It took for a while in different places how long it lasted. And that then raised a problem. And the initial response was to say, well, in that case, we've got to be, since God won't tell us, we've got to be absolutely sure before we execute you. I'm not sure if they applied this to everything or only execution. Some of it looks as though it may be coming out of the Old Testament rules in Jewish law, but you're supposed to have evidence clear as the noonday sun, which meant either two eyewitnesses to the crime or a voluntary confession. And you can see the problem this arises, that usually when somebody kills someone, there aren't two eyewitnesses to the crime. If you are prudent, you don't kill people in public, and you may not want to voluntarily confess. So the solution to that is that if we think you're guilty, we get to torture you. And once you've confessed, we now have a confession. Now, you might say there's a small problem with this. That's not a voluntary confession. Oh, we can solve that problem. You stop torturing him. Now we're not torturing him. So now if you confess, it's voluntary. Well, if you don't confess, I guess we'll have to torture you some more. Not a very satisfactory solution. But that, at least, if you look at my book, I cite the article where somebody, a fairly prominent law school professor who looked at history, went through this, and that was his conclusion of what had happened. But he then wanted to point out that really we are in exactly the same situation. We don't do it by torture. But in our system, if you go back to 18th century England, which is what our system was coming out of, you're talking about a jury trial that's handling maybe 10 cases a day with one jury. All right, that's perfectly doable given the crime rates. We now have a system where a single jury trial can easily go for weeks, sometimes longer than weeks. And if you try to, I have a rough estimate in the book, and I conclude that if we really had all felony trials done as fully as trials, that would absorb at least as many judges as there are in the U.S. of all sorts. And I think I worked it out, maybe a million or 2 million other people between jurors and court attendants and so forth. So it would be enormously difficult, not literally impossible, for us to actually do what our system in theory is doing. So we have this nice, simple, elegant solution, just like they did, just a different one. We've given them lots of rights to avoid convicting the innocent. Now jury trials take too long to use for all felonies, indeed for any noticeable number. So replace it by confession, not by torture, by the threat of higher penalties. All right? So again, he argued, and I think he's probably right, you're trying to make sure you don't convict any innocent people, and you end up with a system that can be expected to convict innocent people. Jewish law went even farther on paper. You not only needed two eyewitnesses, but you're supposed to have two eyewitnesses who had warned the criminal in advance that what he was doing was a capital offense. And then if you look at Maimonides, he discusses the various ways you can get around this. He starts out by saying, basically, even if guy runs in with somebody else, you come into the room, there he is with a bloody knife in his hand, standing over the dead body, that's not enough. That's not two eyewitnesses to the, not any eyewitnesses to the crime itself. But there are various other ways around it which he discusses. And if none of the other ways work, well, you lock them up and you don't feed them very much and you beat them a whole lot and you mistreat them for a lot of time for years and years so that nobody will think that by getting around this, he can pull it off. So Islamic law requires for a hot offense, these are the five offenses that are thought of as having fixed penalties set in the Quran. You have to have two eyewitnesses, both of whom must be adult male Muslims of good reputation. For zina, which is unlawful intercourse, it requires four witnesses to the same act of intercourse. Not a very likely situation. But, on the other hand, there are other parts of the Islamic legal system, not Had, the Tazir and the Shurta and so forth, which don't have these high requirements, which impose somewhat lower penalties, but can still impose some penalty. Penalty for zina, the Had penalty for zina is execution, stoning to death if the person has had legitimate intercourse before, and 100 lashes if he or she hasn't. And at least some schools of Islamic law hold that under Tazir, the judge can convict on his own knowledge. So if the judge knows you're guilty from his own observations, he can convict you. Right. So in all of these systems, including ours, the argument is you, on the one hand, don't want to convict innocent people, but in the process of changing your institutions to prevent that, you end up with an unworkable system, and getting out of that unworkable system leaves you back with a system that can easily convict innocent people. Let's think of the question of standards of proof and of how you would decide how careful you have to be. All right? And in deciding, think there are lots of other variables. If you just ask the question of how sure do we have to be? Do we have to be 95% sure or 99% sure or whatever? And the trade-off is that the higher your standard of proof is, the more guilty defendants you're going to acquit. So if you lower the standard of proof, you can acquit fewer guilty defendants, convict more guilty defendants. But then if you lower the standard of proof, you're going to convict more innocent defendants. So that's the ultimate trade-off. And, of course, as an economist, say, well, wait a minute, what's the cost of convicting somebody or failing to convict somebody? And it may then occur that different parts of the legal system, there are different costs to error. So if you make an error in the tort system, what does that mean? It means that sometimes somebody pays someone else money that you really shouldn't have to pay. If you make an error in for a capital crime, it means somebody dies who doesn't have to die. Well, if I pay you money, it's true I lose, but at least you gain. So if you imagine sort of a random sequence over time, sometimes I pay you money I shouldn't have to pay, and sometimes you pay me money I shouldn't have to pay. If you imagine errors in the criminal system, sometimes I get executed when I shouldn't get executed, and sometimes you get executed when you shouldn't get executed. That's a net deadweight loss in a sense in which the other one isn't. And even if it's not execution, the same argument applies for time in jail and flogging and other possible criminal penalties. So that suggests that for criminal punishments, we want a higher standard of proof. We want to be more careful not to make mistakes than for civil punishments. All right. How about ways of reducing the cost of error? Well, one way of doing it is to replace a criminal-style punishment with a tort-style punishment. So the jinniyat in the Islamic law says if you have committed first-degree murder, the kin of the victim have the option of demanding retaliation, demanding to have you executed. But they also have the option of receiving 100 camels as diya, as wergeld, as the compensation. And if they do that, then the net cost across the whole society is about zero. They lose 100 camels. You get 100 camels. Whereas if you execute them, somebody dies and nobody extra lives. Yeah? I don't know where you've heard about it, but dia is the Arabic, wergeld is the Icelandic for blood money in the sense that, yeah, that's right. And in modern day Saudi Arabia, which is the closest thing, I think, to a modern society under Islamic law, I'm not sure what happens for first degree murder, but if you killed somebody sort of accidentally, you both, I think, get imprisonment for some length of time, which would not be Islamic law, and owe his kin a sizable money compensation.
I heard it in the context of the U.S. military had accidentally bombed a village, and they paid the village survivors off.
Yes, that would be appropriate under Islamic law. If it was an accident, then for accidental death, the kin don't have the option of retaliation. All they have is the option of collecting a dia, smaller dia than feud law, which I discussed a couple of weeks ago, where what you're doing is saying, you wronged me, I will attack you unless you fairly compensate me. Well, if it ends up with compensation, then we've again got a relatively low cost kind of cost of error. And in privately prosecuted criminal law, what I discussed for 18th century England and also a little bit for Periclean Athens, you have a system where I prosecute you. If you're convicted, you may get hanged. But if you will compensate me in a way I find satisfactory, maybe I will not show up for the court case and you won't get convicted. And, of course, I'm not mentioning it here, but if you think about the 18th century system, if what happens to you is transportation, if you become an indentured servant in the New World for 14 years, well, you're losing 14 years of your freedom, but on the other hand, somebody or other is getting your labor. So there's at least less than if you just hang people. Next question is, are there technologies for revealing truth? Are there ways in which a legal system can find out what's true and thus make it more likely that you convict the guilty and acquit the innocent? And one of the ways you do it has to do with the rules for jury selection. The medieval system was the opposite of our system. All right? In our system, if you know anything at all about the case, you're not supposed to be on the jury. In the medieval system, the jury was made up of neighbors of the person who was being tried. And that has the advantage that they have a lot of relevant information. They know shouldn't trust this guy. He's lied to several of us about something else a year ago. Or we know we should trust him. And similarly for all the witnesses, not just the defendant. So there are clearly advantages. But, of course, the problem with that is that the neighbors may have their own axe to grind. The neighbors may have grudges against him for one reason or another. One of them may be courting the same woman he's courting, and if we get him executed, I can get her. I think lots of other reasons. So the modern system reverses it. The modern system, we insist on an uninformed jury, and that avoids the bias of neighbors, but also throws out all of that specific information that the informed jury would have, and it requires somebody else in our system, the prosecutor and the defense, pick up all of the relevant information and offer it to the jury in order to get a decision. So that's one, in a sense, we don't think of that as a technology, but it really is a technology. It's a way of trying to find out something. The question of the adversarial versus inquisitorial procedure. And inquisitorial sounds evil to us, but in fact it's the standard system outside of the English-speaking world. And the basic difference between the two is that the adversarial system, the theory of that is that you've got one person or group of people with the job of proving he's guilty, a different one with the job of proving he's innocent. That means you've got people working for getting information of both sides, and hopefully that then gives the jury all of the relevant information.
What's the inquisitorial
system? The inquisitorial system is one where the judge and his employees are supposed to be finding out what happened, so that you have essentially a government employee or a group of employees who investigate the case, bring in the evidence, and then the case is tried on that basis. And one obvious objection to the adversarial is that it's sort of wasteful, because if I'm working for the defense and I come across something that looks like it's evidence that my guy is guilty, I'll look the other way. And if you're working for the prosecution, in theory, you're in favor of justice. But if you expect that whether or not you get promoted depends on whether or not you win cases, you've got a strong incentive, if you find evidence the guy is innocent, to look the other way. And I guess we saw a rather striking case of that for those who followed the whole question of the FISA court. Recently, it turned out that when the FBI wanted permission to wiretap somebody associated with the Trump campaign, they neglected to tell the FISA court that at the point when he met with somebody from Russia, he also reported the fact that he met from somebody to Russia with Russia to the CIA. And at least it was the conclusion of the investigation that of the four different warrants that the FISA court gave out over the series of that wiretapping, two of them were invalid. Two of them were based on information which neglected the relevant facts that show that you shouldn't have that warrant. So that's a modern case, and it's not, you know, the FBI isn't literally paid, but if you think about being somebody who is trying to get information, you'd like to be able to wiretap. You suspect there's something wrong going on, so you don't bother to tell the court the evidence that suggests that you shouldn't wiretap. That was a fairly prominent recent case. Yeah?
So you have a situation where a prosecutor at least ignores sort of evidence, and you have the resources to find that out after the fact. Doesn't it get that conviction thrown out?
Well, that's an interesting question. And if I remember correctly, I think this is the one where he pled guilty as a plea bargain, and now wants to withdraw the guilty plea. And I don't know whether the judge doesn't have to let him do that. They may or may not. I don't know what will happen. But in any case, you can't guarantee that it'll ever be caught, right? That is the so the adversarial has this problem that each side has an incentive. But, of course, the inquisitorial, if the judge is sort of honest and his team is honest and all the rest, it's a great system. But, obviously, if the court is biased, it's in a good position to suppress all the evidence against the conclusion it wants, whereas if you had the adversarial team, there's theoretically somebody on his side who's presenting that evidence. So, but that's, again, it's really a technology for discovering truth, and each technology has advantages and disadvantages. Rules on surveillance, going back to the wiretapping case. It's clear that from the standpoint of the police, the ability to wiretap people, spy on them, do a bunch of things that makes it easier to catch criminals, right? I mean, that's a pretty straightforward kind of argument. Hard to deny it. But on the other hand, the ability to do that also means that you can find out that the politician who was opposing your desire to do something is having an affair and threaten to reveal that affair. I gather, I don't know the details, but I gather there was some stuff involving Martin Luther King, where the FBI had evidence of his affairs and was trying to use it in some way, what they wanted him to do, but to do something. So you can see, again, the potential for misusing, for bad effects, from the same tools that you want in order to do your job well. And this is sort of a fairly common problem. And so there again, there's a trade-off. All right. Torture. All right. That's another technology for getting truth. It might be a way of forcing someone to admit his crime and tell you where the loot is hidden. I mentioned the Visigothic solution, which is you only count the confession if the confession contains information that he otherwise wouldn't have known. My suspicion, looking at the things like the Athenian and the Roman rules, my guess is that they thought that a good interrogator could tell whether or not the guy was lying. That is to say, I'm not sure if they were right or not, but I think my suspicion is that they thought if you've got a slave, you're torturing him, he says, yes, yes, my master did such and such, that you are good enough at this so you can tell whether he's just made it up in order to get you to stop torturing him or whether he's really telling you things. But I don't know. But at least we do know that a fair number of past societies used torture. Our society used it, although we didn't admit using it. The so-called third degree consisted of sort of local police officers beating up people in order to get them to confess things. And you can see that it could be very useful, especially if you're torturing somebody and getting him to give you the information that will let you then catch somebody else. But, of course, it has the problem that if you think you know who the somebody else is, you can try to force him to testify against that somebody else, whether or not it's true. That I happen to know somebody who spent, I don't know, a year or two in jail for a crime that I suspect he had not committed. It was a case where his roommate had some stolen property in the apartment. And by his account, he was essentially pressured at a point before he'd been convicted to happen to have heard a cellmate confessing to a much more important crime, which in fact he hadn't heard, and he refused, and he ended up being tried and spending a year or something in jail. And you can, I may be wrong, but I believe his story. I interacted with a guy a fair amount a long time ago, interesting guy, and I think what was going on pretty clearly was that the police wanted to convict somebody of killing someone prominent, and so they say, well, put someone with a minor crime in the same cell and then ask him whether by any chance this guy just happened to confess to you. So you can see that's not torture, but it's the same, that's using the plea bargain mechanism instead of the torturing mechanism, but the same logic. Furthermore, one of the features of torture is that even if you then acquit the guy, you've punished him, right? You've tortured him. And that's not limited to torture. If you think about our criminal process, suppose you are a cop, and you think somebody is a guy who you'd like to do something, who you'd like to hurt, and he hasn't committed a crime. Well, you arrest him on suspicion of a crime. He has to put up a bunch of money as bail, which is expensive, or he ends up spending 6 months in jail, and then you drop charges and release him. So there are lots of ways in which law enforcement can, in practice, impose costs on people. I mentioned my run-in with the TSA, where I concluded that they had deliberately trashed my suitcase because they didn't like something I was doing, even though it was not against their rules. So that's obviously a potential for that system. Yeah?
Was it torture
debunked in the context of after 9/11, the FBI thought to do work for other people who carried out, but it did? Is that a generally accepted thing? I don't know. That is, clearly people disagree about this subject, which makes it... I'm very reluctant to form an opinion on the sort of thing where I know there are a bunch of people who have a reason to claim it's true and a bunch of people who have a reason to claim it's false, and I haven't looked into it myself with any care. It's too easy to convict yourself that whatever you want to believe is what the science proves. And, again, torture or plea bargaining can convict innocent people who confess because it's better than the alternative. And I mentioned the Visigothic solution. Suppose we had a truth pill. Suppose we could do all of this without actually torturing anybody. So we give you a truth pill, and then for the next hour you tell the truth, and you answer questions we ask you, and so forth. All right? So that's going to do what torture is supposed to do, but without the obvious downsides. All right? Lie detectors claim to do that, but as far as I can tell, they really don't. That is, my understanding is that a lie detector basically shows tension, not lying, and that somebody who's clever at using a lie detector can sometimes spot when you're lying. If they tell, give you a series of dates and times, and only the criminal would know the one that's really relevant, and that's when you tense up. But on the other hand, it's entirely possible that the interrogator knows what's relevant, and he tenses up, and then you tense up in response. And it's presumably also possible that with practice you learn to control your blood pressure and whatever else they're measuring well enough so that they can't tell. So, yeah?
So are lie detectors pretty well debunked?
I think that would overstate it, but I think they're regarded as a not very reliable, not that you get no information at all, but they don't give you certain results in either direction. But then the question to me is, suppose we had a truth pill. Are we in favor of allowing its use? Are there arguments? There are arguments for. Are there arguments against? Yeah?
The bad guys who have a pill can use it to get any kind of information on you. They don't have any business knowing.
Your definition of bad guys might be more restricted than mine.
Yeah.
If you think about how we keep governments from doing bad things, all right? One way of keeping governments from doing bad things is to have rules that they're not allowed to do bad things. And that has its limits, right? Because someone in the government is interpreting those rules. Another mechanism for keeping government bad things is to make them unable to do bad things. All right? So if you imagine, you know, take the extreme case. Suppose you're part of a minority, you think the government's going around killing you. Well, if the members of your minority have their own guns, and if every time the government comes to kill somebody, one of them gets killed too, the government might decide not to have quite such a murderous policy. That would be the extreme case. But the less extreme case is if you think that the government, let's take marijuana legalization. If you say, look, I believe that it doesn't make sense to have this kind of law unless most of the population is on board. And furthermore, if most of the population isn't on board with it, you're going to have a hard time enforcing that law, won't you? All right, that was the prohibition, alcohol prohibition would probably be the clearest case. They did not, in fact, succeed in enforcing the law. And one could argue that this is a good thing. That, you know, maybe it was a good law, we don't know for sure. But if you don't trust the government to make good laws, you say having the restriction that you don't have unlimited power to enforce your laws. And therefore, if the law is sufficiently unpopular, you won't be able to. That might be a sensible way of restricting governments. All right? So the point I want to make is we aren't sure that we would really want the truth pill or not. Yes?
In lieu of a truth pill, you use sodium pentothal, give that as an option to the person who is charged.
Yeah.
Here's a line effect attempt for you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the sodium pentothal is the nearest modern equivalent. And again, I don't know enough about it to know how reliable it is, but it's supposed to be a way of doing that. And it's not clear whether you want to allow that or not. All right? And part of it depends on how much you trust your government. If you're really sure that the government is all good guys, but I'm not sure anybody feels that way anymore. I figure half the country feel that Trump proves the government isn't all good guys, and half the country says, yeah, we elected Trump because we knew the government wasn't all good guys. And both halves, in a sense, are right. So, at least that would be my view.
Doesn't the U.S. Constitution prohibit something like a truth pill in terms of self-incrimination?
No, I don't think so. You can do searches as long as you... That is, you can't be legally forced to testify against yourself. But I don't think the people who at least made those rules were considering the question of just getting you drunk so you blab, which is the nearest equivalent in their technology. And they can't do a search without a search warrant, but you could have a system, you had to have a search warrant before you fed him the truth pill or sodium pentothal or whatever. So, in a sense, as an economist, part of what I find interesting is, are there ways of tweaking the system to change the incentives so the people who are doing the prosecuting want to avoid prosecuting innocent people? All right? All our system does is to say, we'll make it harder to convict innocent people, and that's the reason why you prefer on the whole to prosecute guilty people. Can we do any better than that? And there are a number of possibilities. And the Athenian approach is sort of an interesting approach. The Athenians say, if you really had no case, we got 100 jurors and you only got 15 of them to vote for conviction, that's pretty good evidence that you shouldn't have prosecuted the guy in the first place, so we're going to fine you. That's one approach you can imagine. How about a modern system? Suppose what we did was we say, look, you got a full jury, you only got 4 guys to vote your conviction. That's pretty good evidence you had a weak case, so maybe we should take that as evidence against you, the prosecutor. Maybe the rule should be, if that happens 3 times, you're no longer prosecutor. You're fired as DA and your assistant takes over. That's a possible way you could imagine doing it. Or you could go further. Suppose you say you convicted an innocent person. That's incompetence on your part. It's incompetence. Maybe it wasn't malicious, but it's incompetence to do a huge amount of damage to somebody. So therefore, we're going to fire you, or we're going to fine you, or we're going to lock you in jail for a year. You could imagine lots of possible legal rules that try to do that. But there is a problem with those, because now if you have convicted an innocent person, you want to make sure nobody ever finds out. And in fact, if you read the stuff from the Original Innocence Project, it's pretty clear that when they say to a law enforcement body, we'd like to have you cooperate with our doing the DNA test to see whether you can convict an innocent person, the usual answer they get is no. And that they have to go to a good deal of trouble. I'm sure it's not true of every
prosecutor's office, but the impression I got, at least reading Actual Innocence, which is the book from the Original Innocence Project, was that the usual response of law enforcement was, "Now we don't want to dig up all that old stuff." And that was a perfectly reasonable response, even without serious penalties, just because you're going to look bad if it turns out that you've convicted somebody innocent. And also, very likely, the prosecutor said, "But I'm pretty sure he's guilty. So even if the DNA doesn't support it, that won't prove he was innocent. It's just some evidence that he was innocent, and I don't want to free a guilty person." So I think it's easy enough to see that the flip side of trying to penalize people for making mistakes, the good thing is it's an incentive not to make mistakes, but the bad thing is it's an incentive, if you do mistakes, to keep them secret. Right? So there is a real problem. The Athenians have an equivalent in tort, and the equivalent in tort, which I discussed, was that if I sue you and lose, I owe you 1/6 of the amount I claimed you owed me. And we do not know whether that was true of all tort cases, of a subset of tort cases where I only got less than 20% of the jury. We don't have that information, unfortunately. We don't actually have the Athenian law books. We have fragmentary information of various sorts. But we know that at least in some cases that was the case. All right? You can try to punish false witness. That's a way of changing the incentives. In modern U.S. law, perjury is a felony. And in both Jewish and Islamic law, perjury that leads to execution is a capital offense. Seems reasonable enough. My favorite solution in changing incentives is private deterrence. If you go back to the 18th century English system, I'm arguing that one incentive for prosecuting was to get the reputation that if people committed crimes against you, they ended up getting hanged or transported or having bad things happen to them. And the neat thing about that, if you think about it, is that unlike the case of the police, you care whether or not you get the right guy. All right? The policeman doesn't want to get somebody who can't convict, but he gets the same professional rewards if he gets the right guy or the wrong guy, provided he can convict them. But if what you're trying to do is to deter people from committing offenses against you, the guy who really committed it knows whether or not you got the right guy. All right? So therefore, he says, "Look, yeah, I know they hanged somebody for stealing that stuff, but it wasn't the guy who stole it, so stealing it doesn't look that dangerous after all. They'll find some schmuck who they can railroad to the noose. Why should I worry?" And very likely, if the criminal knows it, quite likely other criminals are going to know it. He may even tell them. So the neat thing from my standpoint about that particular system is that it's one where you actually have a selfish incentive to make sure you get the right guy. Not that it does any harm to you to get the wrong guy, but it does you no good, whereas getting the right guy does do you some good. Yes? One hopes to some extent that there are moral pressures, that people feel bad about getting the wrong guy. But I don't think there are material pressures. Let's think about the different mechanisms for enforcement, which we talked about before, and the incentives embedded in them. And two mechanisms in many systems is that any rule that makes it harder to convict even the guilty or a reason not to accuse the innocent. If you need lots and lots of evidence, well, let's only get the people we're sure of, because those are the ones we have lots and lots of evidence for. And also, if your motive is deterrence, for the same reason I discussed before, deterrence depends on getting either the right guy or at least people who potential criminals believe are the right guy. And I'm assuming that potential criminals are likely to be better informed than the general public about whether or not the police are mostly getting the right guy. In ordinary criminal law, rewards to the police and prosecutor, basically promotion, you know, what I think of as a gold star on your report card, depend on conviction, not on guilt. And we don't know what their incentives are with regard to deterrence. That if you say, "Well, we're catching the wrong guys, crime rates are going up, we're not really deterring it," maybe the chief gets fired, maybe he gets a bigger budget. All right? It's not clear whether you have the same incentive as the victim does to actually try to get deterrence. All right? Privately prosecuted criminal law, the 18th century case, where there were
rewards, as I mentioned, we were talking about 18th century England, for some offenses, the crown paid rewards for successful prosecution. Those depend on conviction, not guilt, which led to some unfortunate scandals in the mid-18th century where people who were innocent were getting convicted because other people were lying in order to get the reward. But the private deterrence under that system does depend on getting the right man. Tort law, the damage payment is a reward whether or not the loser is guilty. On the other hand, one reason for suing somebody is to deter people from doing whatever that person did to you, and in that case, you'd like to get the right person. So there are elements in all of these. Feud as a form of law enforcement. If the person who you're accusing of having wronged you really didn't, he doesn't want the reputation that anybody can extort me who wants to, so he has more of an incentive to fight than if he in fact knows he's guilty and therefore doesn't look like a wimp when he gives in. So to some extent, there's some incentive to try to get after the guilty people. Divine enforcement. That's another mechanism that's used in some systems. A lot of Islamic law is enforced only by God. And under Christian doctrine, there were various things that were enforced in foro interno, in the internal forum, by your guilt for doing the wrong thing. Works perfectly if the religion is true. God punishes the guilty and makes no mistakes. To some extent, it works if people believe in the religion, because you know if you are guilty, and that gives a reason not to do things that you think God will punish you for. But, of course, you might be wrong, that you might think something is against divine law that isn't, and perhaps more likely you might think that something you want to do is permitted when it isn't, because every man is a biased judge in his own case. So there are problems with that. How about correcting mistakes? All right, all legal systems make mistakes. If you discover a mistaken conviction, what can you do? Well, for some punishments can be reversed. You can give him back the money that you made him pay you. Some punishments you can at least reduce. If we say, all right, we've ostracized you for a year, we've now discovered you didn't really do what we thought you had done, so we'll stop ostracizing you. That doesn't take back the damages from the first year, but at least it ends it. And similarly, for imprisonment, we can let you out partway through. The person who was punished and exonerated could be compensated. This is pretty uncommon as far as I can tell. Occasionally, modern legal systems will do this. Some modern American states have rules in which they actually compensate somebody who's been falsely convicted. But I don't think any of the systems we looked at has a version of that. Hard to undo the result if the guy's been executed. That's often offered as an argument against capital punishment. I don't think it's a very convincing argument, that you also can't undo the fact that he spent 15 years in jail before you found out. And we very rarely discover our mistakes. That in practice, even if you execute an innocent person, only if it somehow becomes a high-profile case and it turns out there's good evidence, do you ever discover it. And so my guess is that I don't know how many innocent people we execute, but I would guess that only a small minority of them do we ever discover they're innocent. All right, let's see. We're not quite at 2, so let's go on a little bit longer. So far, I've been talking about how we deal with error. Let me now talk about the question of how we make the laws that we're going to enforce. And there are a bunch of different ways of doing it. Start out with divine inspiration. That's basically the underlying Jewish-Islamic system. God tells us what the law is, and we need learned people to figure out what God is saying, but that's the basic source. And then what are the problems? Well, one problem is the text itself may have variant versions. There are, after all, extra books of the Bible, which some people think are part of the Bible and some things aren't. In the case of the Quran, under one of the caliphs, Abd al-Malik, who is not one of the first few, they apparently established a sort of standard version of the Quran and destroyed all variant versions. There is some evidence that that may have happened with the Torah, that I think the Dead Sea Scrolls or something like that had what looked like there were some variant versions of parts of the Old Testament. But even if you get a unified text, in Jewish law, there is the claim that there is an oral Torah as well as the written Torah. And since the oral Torah exists only in the purported memory of legal scholars, you can obviously have disagreements on that. And they dealt with that problem by majority vote of the Sanhedrin, of the sort of their equivalent of a Supreme Court, for deciding controversies. Even if you all agree on what the text says, there's the problem of interpreting that text. This is a big problem with the Quran, because the Quran really is less than the Old Testament, written like a law book. So if the Quran says that you're, take the very simple question, says you're not supposed to drink wine. To begin with, it only says that the third time it discusses the subject. The first two times, it doesn't seem to object to it. But even if you say, fine, God was tightening up the rules as Muhammad got more control over his people, what does drinking wine mean? Does it mean fermented grape juice? Does it mean something alcoholic? Does it mean anything that makes you behave as if you were drunk? And all of those were opinions held by various legal scholars in that tradition at different times. So you have to have some mechanism for interpreting what your divine sources say. There was, in fact, a fairly serious conflict under one of my favorite caliphs, Al-Mamun, not my favorite for this reason, where there was a disagreement over the sort of nature of the sources of authority. The question was usually put as, was the Quran create or uncreate? Was the Quran something written down by Muhammad because it was dictated to him by an angel, or was it something that existed in the mind of God for eternity and then just got sort of downloaded to Muhammad in sections? And for reasons not clear to me, this had actual consequences, and Al-Mamun attempted to force people to go along with his interpretation. This is the so-called rationalist versus non-rationalist dispute in Islam, which what I would think of as the bad guys eventually won after Al-Mamun's death. But in any case, that was an attempt to settle it by using secular authority to make everybody who disagreed with you confess that they were wrong or else get executed. Then there's the problem with the divine inspiration of somebody who says, yep, God did it, and God just told me what the answer was. All right? And I discussed the Oven of Achnai story, which I see as sort of a blanket rejection of all claims of that sort. That the point of the Oven of Achnai story, as I interpret it, is however good the evidence is, even when he can offer you a series of miracles, God's given the law to us, he's given us the job of interpreting it, no new information allowed. All right? And that's, for the Sunni, the claim that Muhammad was the final prophet can be seen as ruling out all such. But the Shia, who divide into different sections, had a series of imams. The 12er Shia had 12 imams after Muhammad, who were ultimately descendants of Muhammad through his daughter, through Fatima. And they were supposed to also be divinely inspired, so they became sources as well. The Fatimids kept running it much longer, and the Nizari still have a divinely inspired imam, the Aga Khan. So that's a particular Shia group where it's still running. All right, how else do you get law? You get it by legislation. That's what we're used to thinking of it as, although it's an incomplete account even for our system. In democracy, you have Congress and Parliament. The Athenian Assembly, which was basically all adult male Athenian citizens who could make it to the Assembly. In the Amish system, the changes in the laws in the ordinung of that particular congregation are proposed by the bishop of the congregation, but they require unanimous assent from the members of the congregation. And if you don't get unanimous assent, you basically keep talking about it until you do, seems to be the rule. It can also be done by a sovereign, such as the Chinese emperor, who pretty clearly did not have to have any legislature approve of his rules. You can do it in the case of the Romani by a sort of an ad hoc procedure, or we say we've really got this problem. Our rules for divorce are sufficiently unfavorable to women who want to be divorced that they start ignoring our rules and just going through the courts. So we're going to loosen up, make our rules less of a problem. And they made some other changes of that sort. But then even when you have legislation, it never covers all questions. So the Imperial Chinese Law is, as far as I know, the biggest effort, at least I've come across, to have a complete mapping, to say, all right, here is the offense, this is the exact penalty, and it didn't work. It's clear if you look at the cases that there were always sort of intermediate cases where they had to somehow fudge it up in order to get the results, so there's still room for interpretation. A different way, or if this is all legislation of one sort or another, whether by the emperor or by Congress, a different way is precedent, binding precedent, and that's part of how our system works. Its advantage over legislation, it's likely to be more detailed. It sort of is coming up with real cases rather than with legislators imagining real cases. More flexible. Disadvantages. One of them is it can be inconsistent across jurisdictions unless the case finally gets up to a higher court that settles it. So there is what's referred to as the law of the circuit, and the law of the Ninth Circuit and the law of the Seventh Circuit are not identical, because they've made on certain issues different decisions, and unless the case gets to the Supreme Court, which is basically if two circuits disagree enough, that'll be a reason why the Supreme Court may eventually accept the case, but no guarantee. There's a further problem. Suppose the judges get their income by getting cases, not an unusual arrangement. And there's at least an interesting article by Clerman, which I cite in the book, where he argues that English law was pro-plaintiff until the 19th century, because until then, it was the plaintiff who, when he introduced the case, decided which of several possible courts it would go to. It's a complicated enough system, so it wasn't unambiguous what court a case went to. The judges got their money by deciding cases. Consequently, the judges had an incentive to be pro-plaintiff, so plaintiffs would bring it to them. And Clerman at least claims that he has evidence that after that rule changed, that the law became less pro-plaintiff, which is neat if he's right. It's a good story, at least. Argument, good or bad, is that courts may respond to change more slowly than legislatures, that judges are in for a long time. If you think about the conflict between FDR and the Supreme Court during the New Deal, FDR eventually won, presumably in part by threatening to pack the court, though he didn't actually do it. But there certainly was a conflict for a while in which FDR had majority support of people. But on the other hand, the Supreme Court thought that some of what he wanted to do was not, in fact, authorized by the Constitution. Correctly, in my opinion. That is, I do not believe that growing crops to feed to your own animals counts as interstate commerce, and yet the basis on which the farm program from then till now has been justified is the claim that that can be controlled because the Constitution says that Congress can regulate interstate commerce. But that was that particular issue. But in any case, that's one of the features. You've got a certain sort of slowing effect if you do it by judge's decisions rather than by the legislature, where Congress, the House gets elected every 2 years, and Senate can change in 2 years. Customary law where precedence is evidence, I think this may be let me go through this, but then we're getting... The Somali or the Bedouin system is one where they're not seen as making law. They're not even seen as following binding precedent, but rather as we think we know what the law is, we're giving an opinion about that, and if a lot of people disagree, maybe we won't get asked to be judges again. Right. Modern example that I like is a case called Annie Lee Turner et al. Versus Big Lake Oil Company. Because this was a case in which you had water that was, I think, if I remember correctly, I think the oil companies had water that they were pumping out in the process of bringing oil, and their holding tank ruptured and did some damage to some of the neighbors. I think that's right, but I have long time since I looked at the case. And the question is, are they liable? And the Texas court went back to a 19th century English case, which had no legal authority, right? In fact, they ended up disagreeing with it. But they thought it was relevant that the English court had held that in that circumstance you were liable. And the Texas court said, well, in what we're doing, you can't really, again, this is memory, so I don't guarantee it's right, but I think what they said is when you're pumping oil, you've got to have that water somewhere. Therefore, making you liable would make it unworkable, so we're going to have the opposite result. But the interesting point from my standpoint is that they were treating the English court not as having authority over them, but as being an expert in the body of common law, which is what our common law is out of as well, and therefore being relevant. Mm-hmm. Amish law, the final decision is by unanimous assent, but what seems to happen is that things where you're not sure if it's forbidden, people do them, some of them do them, and after a while people either decide, yes, it's all right, or it's not all right. If it's not all right, then the next time the ordinance gets revised, we decide you're not allowed to do that, and we insist on your stopping it. All right, so that's something which looks like a change in customary law. Jewish law, similarly. And if you think about norms, which is the form of customary law we're all part of, I obey norms of how professors are supposed to behave. I'm not wearing blue jeans, though I suppose I could be. And how does it change if a professor violates some of those norms? I'm thinking in particular of a friend, not a colleague. He's on the other side of the country. And if he gets away with it, norms may change. And the example that is observed in my lifetime is that professors mostly don't wear ties anymore. All right, I think we might as well take our 10-minute break now, and I'll continue later.
Remember, cookies in the front,
cookies up here,
cookies in the back, cookies everywhere. That was very kind of you to bake for the class.
Seemed appropriate for the last class. I don't know. I'm not. I think I only know one person who was ever a prosecutor. He ended up very skeptical about the process. Randy Barnett, who's been involved in a number of high-profile cases. He was the person who argued that it wasn't clear that Obamacare was constitutional. And everybody said, don't be absurd, and it ended up being ruled constitutional on a 5-4 decision. So that he was right that it was, in fact, that there were serious problems. And a rather weird 5-4 decision, actually, if you look at the basis for it. But anyway. All right, let's get started again. I have remembered to restart my phone, so with luck we'll have a full recording this time. And real systems often mix the various methods for creating law that I've discussed, so that Amish, in one sense, is customary law, but in another, it's legislation by unanimous assent. Jewish law mixes customary and divine law. The Anglo-American legal system that we're under mixes common law, which itself is to some extent traditional law. That is, the precedent is what judges did, but how did they decide what to do it, plus legislation by Congress in the U.S. or Parliament in the U.K. Chinese law, the statutes were made by the emperor, but there were still elements of interpretation. Somali law was a system of customary law, but in part of it, parts of it were coming out of Islamic law, which came from divine inspiration. And Islamic law is based on revelation, but revelation is interpreted by mujtahids, by legal scholars who said, this is what. And that interpretation involved disagreements about which traditions of what the Muhammad had done were really true traditions or not, and a bunch of other issues. And actual Islamic societies had legislation as well. So the Ottoman Empire had the Kanun, which was a set of rules the Sultan had made, which applied to lots of things that weren't covered by Islamic law. So real systems have mixed elements. All right. How do you make good law? That's the question we'd like to answer. Well, if you've got a divinity who will make it for you, or if you've got wise people, what we like to believe the founders were, they can create good law, maybe. But the sovereign may be more interested in laws that keep him in power than in laws that make his subjects better off. You have to worry about that when it's a wise sovereign. Democracy. The theory of democracy is that politicians have to make good laws or we'll vote them out of power. The argument against is rational ignorance. Each individual voter correctly knows that his vote has almost no chance of changing the outcome. I'm assuming that probably all of you are in voting California as I do. You do not have a vote in the presidential election. All right. If California has any significant chance of going Republican, it doesn't matter because the Republican candidate already carried all the rest of the states. All right. So, in fact, reasonably speaking, your vote has a very tiny chance of affecting a local election and essentially no chance of affecting. Yeah. That's an interesting puzzle. Why do people vote?
So there's something.
Ooh, that's correct. I have an explanation for this problem. I want to go to an apparently unrelated puzzle, which I want to claim is not unrelated. Why is it that sports teams are associated with cities and universities? All right. Most enterprises are not. You don't think of Microsoft as the Seattle Microsoft. But you do think of whatever it was, the Brooklyn Dodgers or whoever they are now and so forth. And my answer is that a sizable part of the product they are selling is the pleasure of partisanship. You're not going not just to watch the fun of people doing something hard very well, but to cheer for your team. And having a link to a city or to a university gives you a pre-made set of partisans who can enjoy cheering for their team. Every 4 years, a game is played out across the country with the fate of the world at stake. And you not only get to cheer for your team, you get to play on your team, even if it's a very, very, very small role. So that's my explanation of why we vote. And I think it's a better explanation than the alternative one. It just fits the observed data better. Quite a large fraction of American voters cannot name their legislator, their congressman. Very hard to keep track of what somebody's doing if you don't know his name. And so I think that the example I gave here, which is an example that occurs to economists, is that we worked out the economics of foreign trade 200 years ago. David Ricardo did. With a few tweaks, most economists have agreed on it since. It may be one of the few things that I and Krugman would agree about. Nonetheless, for those 200 years, almost no country has acted on the basis on the implications of that theory. And the two places that did, England in the 19th century and Hong Kong in the 20th century, were both spectacularly successful societies. Yes?
So, but many people these days are registering as independent.
Yeah.
So, by definition, they're not really on either team.
Well, maybe you have to know more about the particular people. They may be on the team of a particular candidate who they like, and maybe they like some Republican and some Democratic candidates. They may have an ideology that they're pushing which doesn't fit well enough. You'd have to know about the particular independent. And also, there's some social pressure. I never wear the little button which says I voted because I'm not proud of having voted. I mean, I vote for the same reason. There's somebody I want to vote against or somebody I want to vote for as an expressive activity, but I don't feel there's any reason other people should look up to me because I've bothered to vote, and sometimes I don't. But
I have a question.
Yes.
Sorry, you said, I know that California doesn't count in the presidential election. But by losing our primary act, we do count in choosing the person who becomes the candidate.
Correct. Correct. Yep. Well, that's right. But in any case, it seems to me that what I think of as the civics class model of democracy, in which it works because you vote the good guys in and the bad guys out, is really a very poor model except for very small societies where a town meeting, you might actually know enough to do that. Judge-made law. Richard Posner, one of the leading law and econ people, federal judge for quite a long time, argued that if you looked at the common law, it made sense to interpret it as a set of economically efficient rules, where what he means by economically efficient is most easily summarized as maximizing the size of the pie, as saying that you're total, somehow some measure of total welfare for the people in the society, these are the rules that make it as large as possible. And that's been a very interesting conjecture, and it's led to a lot of interesting work. In my evidence, I don't think he ever offered a good theoretical reason why it would happen, and I think the evidence we actually do the economic analysis of law is mixed. That if you're sufficiently curious, my book Law's Order can be read for free from my webpage, or you can buy a copy from Amazon. And one of the things I discuss going through that book is where laws do or don't seem to fit economic efficiency. And my favorite example is we have two different legal questions, which economically are identical, are the same question, even though they're applied to a different thing. Each of them, Posner argues that the legal answer is the right answer, and it's the opposite answer in the two cases. He never noticed. But, well, maybe he noticed after I told him. I don't know. But anyway, so I don't think it's at all clear whether it's true, because the problem is that once you know what the law is, it's usually complicated, so you can find some argument to show that that's the efficient rule. So whether Posner's right, I don't know. But that's his claim, at least. All right, what about customary law? And the one I like to think about is the evolution of norms. So suppose there is some set of norms which have the characteristic that if I am a member of a group of people who follow these norms, I, as well as the rest of them, will be better off. So if you think about a norm of honest dealing, if we say, I don't lie to people about the quality of what I sell them, I keep my promises, stuff like that, I associate with other people like that. If I stop doing that, they'll stop associating with me. It's in my interest to adopt those norms, join that community. All right? And I think there are certainly lots of cases where you have some ethnic community which seems to work quite well from that standpoint. People who are concerned with sort of immigration issues talk about the fact that African immigrants seem to do pretty well relative to American blacks. And the African immigrants are largely Nigerians, and I would give odds that most of them are Igbo, and the Igbo did pretty well in Africa, too, even though they fought a losing civil war against the rest of Nigeria.
And I believe they were Christians, too, didn't they not?
Yeah, I don't know if all of them are, but a lot of them are. Yeah. Yeah. That's correct. That's one of the minor things I'm sort of irritated with Trump about, that of all of the countries to stop immigration from, that's one of the stupidest ones. We should let all of them in. When I was a graduate student in theoretical physics at Chicago, there was one black who was part of the elite group, the theoretical group of the graduate students, and he was an Igbo. So I have some prejudices coming out of a small amount of evidence, but that's some evidence. Yeah.
Some difficulty hearing sometimes. Your microphone seems to be louder for some words than not.
I wouldn't be surprised because I'm moving around. And that's probably the reason. Yes, I hadn't even thought about the fact that there was a fixed microphone because I'm used to speaking without a microphone. But thank you for telling me. I will try to stay here. I could just speak louder, I suppose, and then you wouldn't need a microphone. So if you imagine norms of that sort, which I likely to prefer as locally efficient in that they benefit the people who hold the norms, then you would expect that it would be in the interest of people to join groups like that and of other groups to imitate them. So that would be a mechanism that would give you attractive customary law, as it were. But then what about what I think of as a norm that is globally efficient but not locally efficient? That is to say, we're better off if all of us hold it. Other people are better off if I hold it. But I'm not better off if I hold it. In fact, I'm worse. And there's what?
For example?
That's what I was coming to. There is a book called Order Without Law by Ellickson, who is a Yale law professor. It's an interesting book discussing the system of norms in Shasta County, about 2 hours from here, where norms sometimes trump the law of California. But he also discusses other things, and he discusses the norms of 19th century whalers. Bunch of independent ships, and there are situations such as what happens if my ship harpoons a whale. It's got my harpoon with the name of my ship on it stuck in it, but it gets away and then another ship brings it in. And so there were rules about how you then share the result when that happens. And he argues that those norms were in fact efficient norms. And then you can see the norms change as they change what species of whale they're hunting with different characteristics such as different rules work. And I can't reproduce the details, but if you look up Ellickson's book, Order Without Law, it's sort of a fun book, and he goes into detail. But then the question is, why did they change from hunting one species of whale to another? Why do you think that happened? Because they were hunting each species to near extinction. Well, hunting a species to near extinction is probably not in the interest of whalers. But for each individual ship, it's in their interest to catch one more whale, because if they don't catch it, the odds are very low that they'll be the ones who get it or its children next round. All right? So that's what I think of as a norm to restrict the hunting of whales might well be globally efficient. It may, if all the whalers followed it, they might all be better off. But any whaler who follows it is worse off. Yeah. Yeah, that's an example of Tragedy of the Commons, sure. Tragedy of the Commons is an example of what I refer to as market failure in general, situations where somebody makes a decision and the benefits and costs of those decisions mostly go to other people, with the result that it may be in his interest to make the decision when on net it shouldn't be made, or to not make it when on net it should be made. And Tragedy of the Commons and Prisoner's Dilemma and public good problems are all examples of that. And it's got nothing in particular to do with markets, instead of its, in spite of its name. It applies on markets and lots of other places. So that suggests that there's going to be some tendency to get efficient rules under customary law, but a limited tendency, because it'll get the one set, it'll get the honest dealing, but it won't get the restricted catch. One fairly nice mechanism for getting good law is a competitive system where the parties are somehow choosing their law in advance, and there are a number of examples. In the Islamic case, you are choosing sometimes you can choose which of the four schools of law. So consider the case of two individuals who are forming a contract. They can agree in advance, we think Maliki contract law works better than Hanbali contract law. So we will register our contract with a local Maliki court, and then that court will enforce it. All right, so that's a mechanism that might give you efficient rules. And in the U.S., when you form a corporation, you decide which state you incorporate in, and that's usually Delaware, and presumably what's going on is that Delaware has developed corporate law that the people forming corporations think is desirable. All right, so that gives you a mechanism. And for ordinary contracts, one way of thinking of contracts is as a miniature legal system, that we make this agreement, and you agree, well, if I don't deliver the goods by such and such a time, here's what I'll owe you. And if there's a dispute, here's how we settle it. So that, again, looks something that you might expect to do a better job of leading to efficient rules, at least between the parties. All right? You might get efficient rules for murder contracts, for example, which aren't efficient for the victim. They're efficient for the employer and the assassin. All right. Let me go on to the question of who will guard the guardians. And those of you who know Latin may recognize this as quis custodiat ipsos custodes, who will guard the guardians. And almost everybody thinks that this is a political issue. But the actual origin of the phrase, it turns out, is in a Latin poem. And it discussed the problem of keeping a wife faithful. And that after all, you've got somebody who's guarding the wife, and then she can pay the guardian off with herself to get permission to be unfaithful to you. If you want to see a much more entertaining discussion of this issue, there's a poem by Matthew Prior, 18th century English poet, who I rather like, called The English Padlock, where he gives the correct solution. The end of it is, let all her ways be unconfined and set your padlock on her mind. But it's a neat poem. And I've got a link, so this is all up on the class webpage, so you can follow the link for yourself if you want to read the poem. Yes, exactly. Very good. All right. So, but usually we use the phrase in the political legal context, which is the one I'm using it now. I just think it's amusing where it comes from. Law exists in part to keep people from doing bad things, but how do we keep the people enforcing the law from doing bad things? That's the fundamental problem that we're concerned with. How do we enforce the law on the enforcers? We've seen several possible solutions in looking at different legal systems. One of them is not to have any specialized enforcers. System of private norms, I can cut you dead, you can cut me dead. I can not think highly of you, you can think not highly of me. The whole mechanism for enforcing the norms don't involve anybody with a special position. All right? It's also true in a feud system. But in a feud system, there is nobody who is outside of the system, and everybody is inside in the sense of having the same, some people have more access to force than others, but everybody is essentially in the same general position. And to some degree, our tort system or 18th century English criminal system is a system without specialized enforcers. Anybody can sue anyone. So in that sense, now there are specialized deciders. The judge can be sued, but it's a judge who will decide who wins the case. And in the English system, it was possible when a justice of the peace told troops to fire on a crowd to have him charged with murder and tried for murder. But in those systems, not the feud system, but the tort system and the 18th century English criminal system, the enforcers have a veto. That AT&T turned over evidence to the National Security Agency in violation of their obligations as then recognized to their customers, and Congress immunized them. If the justice of the peace in the English case I gave had been convicted, the king could have pardoned him. So it gives some protection, but somewhat limited, unlike a feud system. And that gets me to one of my favorite sagas, Egil Saga. And Egil Saga, King Harald Fairhair has more or less unified Norway under himself. Kveldulf's elder son becomes one of Harald's retainers, accumulates enough power and wealth so that Harald gets worried about him, and Harald eventually attacks him and kills him. And at that point, Kveldulf and his younger son, Skallagrim, decide that Iceland is really a better place to be than Norway. And they load up their people and their as much of their stuff as they can in their longships and head off. But on the way, they stop on some islands that are off the coast of Norway. And Kveldulf then spends each day sitting on a rock at the end of the islands. And you've had an implication earlier in the saga that Kveldulf, in some sense, knows more than he ought to know. His name translates as Evening Wolf. And he tells them, load up all of the fighting men in one ship and go after that ship. And the ship that's coming by is a ship that had been stolen by the king from Kveldulf's older son, and which currently contains a bunch of the king's people and two of the king's nephews. I should say, before this, Skallagrim had asked the king for Wergeld, but the king refuses to give for the killing of his brother. Kveldulf and Skallagrim and their people attack the ship. They go berserk. One goes down one side of the ship and one goes down the other side, and more men die from drowning than from sword blows. So Saga tells us. And when it's all over and the two nephews are dead, they fish one of the people out and say, go tell Harald. I'm Kveldulf, he's Skallagrim, go tell Harald. Sets off a feud that runs through the saga. Even kings pay Wergeld in a feud system, or else in this case. And that's one of the several things Egil Saga is about, is the feud between the royal family of Norway and a family of Icelandic farmers. And the Icelandic farmers do pretty well for themselves, all things considered. Another solution is have a second layer of enforcers, civilian review board in our system. In the Islamic system, the Nazar fil Mazalim existed to investigate complaints against judges or officials. In the Imperial China, the censors, which are not censors in our sense, but that's what they called them, the censorate. If you do very well on the civil service exam, make it through these three layers, somewhere in the top fraction of 1% of the academics, you become a magistrate. If you do even better, you are a censor with the job of investigating magistrates. Interesting system. Another solution is to use one part of the law enforcement system against another part. The FBI, I think, has recently arrested somebody in San Francisco. I'm not sure if what he was doing involved law enforcement. It was some kind of a government official on a claim of corruption of some sort. You can use tort law, which is privately prosecuted against law enforcement misdeeds. So that in 1969... a bunch of Chicago cops come to an apartment full of sleeping people and open fire and kill two of them. And there's pretty good evidence, I think, that it was deliberate first-degree murder, that one of the two people they wanted to kill had apparently been drugged to make sure he didn't wake up while they did it by one of his people who was working for the cops. None of the policemen were ever charged with anything, although
I think the DA who covered up the matter got charged but acquitted. However, the survivors sued, and the city, county, and state settled for a substantial amount of money. Steve Jackson case, if you're curious about it, Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games, who did various role-playing games kind of things. That is the paper material. This is pre-internet, really. And the Secret Service got confused and basically thought that something that was actually a manual for playing a game about hacking into computers was a manual teaching people how to hack into computers. And they seized the manuscript, all computer copies, and I think all print copies of an unpublished book, which happens to be illegal under U.S. law, and held them for a substantial period of time after it had been pointed out to them by Steve Jackson's lawyer that it was illegal. And Steve Jackson sued. He did not get nearly as much damage as I think he should have been, but he won the case. And Hinkle versus Money is one of the early punitive damage cases in English law, 18th century, and that was a case where their equivalent of the Secret Service went out with a blank warrant. They went out with a warrant saying they could arrest anybody who had been associated with the publication of a particular anonymous journal, which had said some unkind things about the King of England. And one of the people who they arrested under that, they held him prisoner in his house for like 18 hours while they searched the house. And he sued and collected damages from the Secretary of State. So that's arguably the origin of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, because that's the case that established the principle in English common law that you couldn't have a warrant that didn't name who its target was. I was talking earlier about this English 18th century journalist politician. This is part of that same set of controversies. On the other hand, in the tort cases, the money ends up being paid by the state, not the offender, almost always. That generally the individual offender is held not to be suable, as it were, and there's some legal question about that. And I think the Institute for Justice, if I'm not mistaken, has been litigating against it. So it is an incentive for the state not to let its employees do bad things, but not a direct incentive for the employee, and a damage payment that's large for an individual is small for a state. Mm-hmm. Interesting book related to some of this by David Brin called The Transparent Society. I think the first couple of chapters are worth reading. I didn't think the rest of it was all that good, and I have my own reservations about Brin, but it's still neat. And he is looking at surveillance. And this was a fair while ago, so this was, I would guess the book was written 15 or 20 years ago. And he is imagining a future where in all public places and maybe some not so public places, there are video cameras. We have good enough face recognition software, which is currently a controversial issue, so that once you do the video, you can have a computer figure out who it is. And we've got good database software so that the information can easily be accessed. So I like to imagine that you have a trial, and the prosecutor is a little bit out of date, says to the defendant, "Where were you at 3 p.m. on Saturday the 17th? And his assistant, who is a little bit more up to date, sort of taps him on the shoulder. "Oh, I'm sorry. That's where you were at 3 p.m. There's the film." All right, so you could certainly imagine that kind of a world in the not-too-distant future, the way things are going. Could be a nightmare of government control. Brin doesn't think it can be stopped. But he suggests that it does have a flip side to it, which is we're going to have the film of the police officer's misdeeds as well as of the other people's deeds. And my response when I read the book originally quite a while ago was, that doesn't work too well if the system for doing the observation is controlled by the government. They can make sure that when they beat up a guy in the police station, it just happens the video camera is broken. On the other hand, Brin was more nearly correct than I thought, because the real version so far is that the police beat someone up where someone else can video it, and nowadays everybody has a video camera in his pocket. And the police control neither the cameras nor the data. However, this still requires an honest system for punishing them after the fact. But I think it is the case that along roughly the lines Brin suggested,
The fact that we're quite likely to have video evidence of police misdeeds makes it somewhat more difficult for police to do bad things, which strikes me as some progress. Now, I've wondered a while if as we get better and better at what they refer to as deep fakes, this may stop working, because the mere fact that I have a video showing the policeman beating someone up doesn't mean it really happened. It could just be the equivalent of Photoshop done in video. That's going to raise some other interesting issues. Some of this stuff is in my book, Future Imperfect. Yeah?
You can go back to Rodney King.
Yes, of course. That's what I'm talking about.
And I don't think that was a fake video.
No, of course not. But we're getting better at doing fake videos. My point is that might not work 10 years from now. That 10 years from now, the police might plausibly argue it didn't really happen. Someone who didn't like us forged this video. The Rodney King case is what I was just describing as the situation in which Brin's method works, but I was suggesting that it might cease to work very well as we got better and better at doing fake videos, and therefore they became less believable.
But it didn't work.
Well, the policeman got... but they got into trouble. Look, there's nothing that works in the sense that you can always get people to get punished for their misdeeds, but nonetheless, the fact... They wouldn't have gotten into trouble at all 5 years earlier in the same situation. Yeah. Yeah, that's why some people pressure that police should have to have cameras on them. That's obviously one of the problems. That's the broken camera in the police station. It's obviously there aren't any perfect solutions, but. Chain of title is what is.
Fire to the camera.
That's right.
To the source.
That's right. But that again, that's a further difficulty. Yeah. That's chain of title for evidence in cases. It's the same issue. That here is this marijuana sample. How do I prove that I got it out of your house? Old version of doing this is that the ruler holds open court for complaints against his officials. And I've got a quote from Richard Burton, the real Richard Burton, the one who the actor is named after, translator of The Thousand Nights and a Night, African explorer and adventurer, guy who succeeded in going on the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, which non-Muslims were not supposed to do, disguised as a Muslim. Very interesting character. Anyway, Muslim kings are expected, like the old Guebre monarchs, to hold darbar, give public audience at least twice a day, morning and evening. Neglect of this practice caused the ruin of the caliphate and of the Persian and Mughal empires. That's at least his account. Might even be true. That's, I think, from a footnote in his translation of The Thousand Nights and a Night. Democracy. If the rulers don't control the enforcers, vote the rulers out. Well, we didn't discuss pirate law, but the chapter is there. And the pirate ships were democracies, very small democracies, might very well work on their scale. But in a democracy of 300 million people, it's very hard to know what is happening, whether abuses are real or not. If Trump doesn't do bad things, the Democrat will say he does. And if he does do bad things, a lot of Republicans say he doesn't. So it's really hard and mostly not worth bothering. Cheer for your side. Your vote isn't going to affect what really happens. All right, final chapter is ideas we can use. And I'm going to start with the idea of marketable torts that I stole from the Icelanders. And that provides a way in which the weak can get their rights protected, because you can transfer your claim to someone who can better collect it. And then, with luck, get a share of the damage payment. In modern day America, making tort claims transferable could solve three different problems. First, if you can't afford a lawyer and somebody damages your car or in some other way commits a tort against you, how do you get your rights protected? And if you've got a clear enough case, you might make a deal with a law firm where they would say, we'll take half the money and you get half the money. That does exist, but you can't just sell your claim to the highest bidder. And you don't know which law firm will do a good job. How do you get the most out of your claim? Well, you don't know which lawyer will do the best job, but you know who offers you the highest price for your claim. All right, it's a nice, simple mechanism. Finally, we have this problem of torts with diffuse effects, $10 each on 10 million people. And we try to solve it
by having class actions, and class actions have a whole lot of problems, and you get the sort of settlement where the defendant says, yes, indeed, I will pay $10 million in damages. This will consist of $2 million to the lawyer and an $8 million discount to everybody who buys my next year's product. And I'm only slightly exaggerating what happens. And that makes sense for the lawyer, but not so much sense for the people who are suing. But suppose that we made torts transferable. Somebody buys up millions of small claims. And the way you imagine doing it is you don't buy up specific claims. You say, we will pay you, we'll give you a discount on your life insurance if you agree to transfer to us all claims for less than $100 that you might have. Now, an enterprising lawyer says, look, here is an issue that nobody else has noticed, where a whole bunch of people are suffering $10 or $15 or $20 losses. I'm going to buy 12 million claims for that particular issue from the middlemen who hold them. I will then sue in my own name as the owner of all of those claims. So it's an interesting possibility of a different mechanism for a class action. How about liability for prosecuting the innocent? Well, I'm getting this one out of Pericles in Athens. All right, we went through this. The losing plaintiff could owe damages to the prevailing defendant, and the prosecutor, you got less than 20% of the jury, was fined. Since courts make mistakes, it sometimes pays to sue on a weak case. That imposes the cost on the innocent defendant who might lose. In our legal system, even though in a tort case you lose only by a preponderance of the evidence, we act as if we were sure you were guilty. That if the court finds that the odds are 60% that you did it, you owe the full amount. Well, it then seems logical to say that when he wins, we will treat him as certainly innocent. If he is certainly innocent, then the plaintiff did him a harm, even a probabilistic harm, because he could have lost by suing him, so therefore the plaintiff shall owe him damages. And this could be a solution to the patent troll problem that I discussed, I think, a week or two ago, because you would then have a situation where if they're suing on a weak case, they are at risk of themselves ending up owing damages to the people they're suing. Criminal prosecutor in our system can charge the defendant with things he did not do. Indeed, prosecutors routinely charge defendants with things they don't expect to convict them of because they intend to have a plea bargain in which they drop the stronger charges. And one might say there's something dishonest about doing that, but it certainly has problems in order to get him to plead guilty to a lesser offense, which it might be in his interest for an innocent person to do since he's going to prison for 1 year instead of life, even if it's only a risk of life. How do we penalize the prosecutor for doing this if we want to stop that behavior? We could imagine a case in which if he does go to trial and hardly anybody votes for conviction because he refuses the plea bargain, and so the prosecutor says, all right, I'll try to prove that you're guilty of murder and not of manslaughter or accidental death or whatever it really was. You could say, once that happens, once or several times, we say, sorry, this prosecutor is a bad guy. He's never allowed to prosecute a case again. And in the Athenian system, if you lost one of these 20% cases, you were then barred, I'm not sure forever, for 3 years or something, from ever prosecuting a case of that in that class of cases again. So those are things we might use the ideas. What about rules that reveal information? And my example here is, again, from Pericles in Athens. I like Pericles in Athens. That's a clever system. And I described how you proved that somebody else was richer than you were. You offered to trade everything you owned for everything he owned. And if he turned you down, he admitted he was richer. So he had to do the thing that you were supposed to do. Same approach. Not only can be used in a modern society, somebody pointed out to me something I didn't know, that it is routinely used in our society. Not in a legal context. Well, first, the one everybody knows about is I cut, you choose. That's the system where it's in my interest to make an even division, because otherwise you'll get the big slice of the cake. All right? It's the same elegance. It's a neat idea. But the one I didn't know about is claims race. You want to set up a horse race in which people have an incentive to enter horses that are all about equally good. A $10,000 claims race, when you enter your horse in the race, you are making a binding commitment to sell it to any taker for $10,000. So you could put a really good horse in that race. He'd win that race, but it's the last race he'd win for you because then somebody would buy him.
So it's a rather neat way of making, you know, the interest of the owners of the horses to put in ones which are good enough to have a chance of winning the race, but not much better than that, and thus getting a competitive race. So that was really clever. And you could imagine something people have occasionally proposed, though other people don't like it, a self-assessed property tax, where the way we evaluate your property for taxation is you have to set a price on your property, and you have to be willing to sell it at that price. That would essentially be the equivalent of the Athenian system. All right. If you wanted to tax wealth, you could imagine using the Athenian approach. You declare the total value of everything you own, and you have to be willing to transfer it to anybody willing to pay that price. And you can think for yourself about whether or not there are other ways in which that mechanism would work in a modern society.
I was thinking it's just outside of that, the I-cut-and-choose approach. And it occurred to me, you know, that there's an incentive in the one who's doing the cutting to do the packaging of the cuts so that one cut looks better than the other to the average chooser. And
yes.
Therefore, still comes out ahead.
This is, in a way, what the book Nudges is about, how you present things so people make the choice you want them to make. Anyway, you can think of other examples, but it struck me as sort of neat. Privately prosecuted criminal law, Periclean Athens and 18th century England are the cases we've discussed. But in U.S. law, there are some statutes that provide for what's called a private attorney general, where a private person can prosecute what's essentially a federal government offense. Should we apply that more broadly? And the problem that could help solve is the problem that I think of as the king's friends can get away with murder. That if criminal law can only be prosecuted by the government can choose not to prosecute crimes it approves of, most obviously crimes committed by government actors such as police, and it sometimes does. There are, you know, some fairly notorious examples. The Director of National Intelligence asserted to Congress, as far as I can tell, under oath, that the NSA did not collect any sort of information at all on millions of Americans. And then Snowden's revelation demonstrated that it, in fact, did collect quite a lot of information on pretty nearly everybody. And he was never tried for perjury, which is a felony. The president two back, Mr. Bush, as far as we can tell, violated the FISA statute by knowingly using information that had been acquired by wiretaps that were supposed to require a FISA warrant and didn't have one. He confessed to doing that, and he's still a free man. Did not end up paying, I think it's 5 years or $10,000, if I remember correctly, is the statutory penalty for that offense. Private prosecution would solve that problem, but it might raise other problems. Because you can easily enough imagine you've got a grudge against somebody, you're both 20, and you manage to get evidence that he drank some beer, and you try to get him jailed, which in some states you can do for that offense, because you want the girl who he's also pursuing, or any other reason. You can think of lots of cases. Yes?
I think you're wrong about this.
Yes, right.
And they get a cut.
Yes,
they get some money
right.
From doing that. And that just occurred to me because it somehow fits.
Yeah, well, that's like the Athenian case for prosecuting criminal offenses, except that ours is only a special case, not a general one.
But this would not be criminal.
Yeah. Yes. The distinction between criminal and civil is a stronger distinction for lawyers than it is for me, since I think of them as just two mechanisms for doing the same kind of work. So we could be worried about that. But then it raises the interesting question. As you say, there are some offenses you shouldn't bother to prosecute, like the 19-year-old drinking beer, or maybe the 17-year-old sleeping with his 17-year-old girlfriend, which is a serious crime in a good many states, probably including this one, I suspect. But then the question is, should the government engage in selective prosecution? That you would think the legislature makes the law. Consider Obama's treatment of the Dreamers. All right, that's a pretty clear case where he's doing something that ought to be done by changing immigration law. He can't change immigration law, so he just tells his people don't enforce this particular law. On the other hand, given the limited resources, it's hard to see how you can insist on all offenses being prosecuted. So it really is a, and to some extent, allowing private prosecution would allow all offenses to be prosecuted, or at least if anybody at all wanted to do it. Alternatively, maybe we shouldn't pass laws we don't want to enforce. Feud law exists de facto within some modern subcultures such as the Romani. It's implicit in the enforcement of norms, in many illegal uses of force, such as interactions between street gangs. And arguably, I argued earlier that the legal conflicts such as patent infringement suits involve a sort of an implicit feud law where if you sue me on a weak case, I can sue you in a weak case. And recognizing the existence and the logic of feud law helps us understand such systems. And one could imagine a modern society built on some modern version of feud law. And if you don't think you can imagine such a thing, let me recommend part 3 of my first book, Machinery of Freedom, published in, I think, 1972, as I remember, in which I invented an imaginary set of modern institutions in which there was no government and a competitive private set of mechanisms for making and enforcing law. And it was quite a lot of fun. And one of my conclusions from the work that led to the course that this is coming out of was that I had been reinventing the wheel, that in fact what I had was a fancy modern version of what had existed in a variety of past societies in a more primitive version. So that was sort of part of what I found intriguing about all of this work. All right, I think that finishes what I have to say, but I wanted to end by putting a question to you having to do with a puzzle that I have never, to my satisfaction, solved over a long period of time. So the question is, would this course work better if instead of doing it the way we're doing, with me spending 2 hours talking, each day of the course you read the chapters that are going to be covered, we all come into class, you ask any questions that occur to you, say anything you want to say, either when you run out of questions or when 2 hours have passed, we go home again. All right? Would that be a better mechanism? And this is related to the puzzle that struck me a long time ago. And that puzzle is, why did the mass lecture format, this is not quite that format because we're small, the numbers are small enough so we can actually have interaction. But think about the kind of college course where you've got 200 people in the audience and some famous professor talking. And there's very, very little interaction. It looks to me as though a book dominates that mechanism, as though, you know, you, if you're lucky, you get the best professor at your university. You can read the best book on the subject ever written. The professor, you've got to go to the class at a particular time and sit there. The book you can read in your bed at 1 a.m. if that's when you like studying. The professor, everybody goes through it at the same speed. The book, you can go over the part that's hard for you 3 times and go quickly over the stuff that's obvious. So the question is, why is it that the mass lecture format survived the invention of the printing press? So that's my final puzzle. Most of you think that that mechanism wouldn't work, right? Right. Yeah, I did the experiment a long time ago when I wrote my price theory textbook and the students didn't like it, so I stopped.
It would work with it. When I was working on my master's in history, we didn't have big lectures. We had 8 to 12 people sitting around the table discussing the books that we had.
Yes. Yeah, but the question is not, I can understand the interaction versus the book. What it understands is the non-interaction lecture versus the book. So why is it that it seems to people as though having me spend 2 hours discussing the ideas, essentially giving you a subset of the book, works better than just reading the book? Yes. I read faster than I talk, and I think most people probably do. And you could presumably set up a rule, you know, set your phone to buzz at various times and say, all right, I've committed myself that I will spend 7 to 9 o'clock every... Anyway, yes.
Yeah.
committed to reading the whole book.
Are you assuming this? How long is this synopsis? Is the, yeah, I guess if I didn't think the other pages were important, I wouldn't have written them. this is getting too much to my vision of college courses in which you've got a textbook, and when you look at it at the end of the semester, there are all this stuff that's been marked out, like, you know, 5% of it. And that's because the student believes if he only memorizes that 5%, he can pass the test. And my reaction as an author is, why are the other 95% there?
It could spark your interest.
Yeah, it could.
But to do it in a classroom setting, I think it would work if you had a smaller sample of reading to do.
Yeah.
People have time to sit down and read a smaller sample of reading.
Yeah.
They're interested.
Yeah, it's an interesting question for a moment. How many hours would it take to read the whole book? And I'm not sure. Yeah?
I think you underestimate the charm of a storyteller. There's something human about listening to you tell about your sagas rather than...
You could be right. On the other hand, I spend quite a lot of time reading stories by people who are good written storytellers.
Even that.
Because I do... See, one of the things that I try to do in writing books is to write it in such a way that it feels to the reader as though there's a human being on the other side of the page.
Uh-huh.
So that I put in comments which are not really essential for what I'm saying, but which are essential for sort of reflecting my personality in order to get the kind of effect you're describing. I don't know. It's certainly true that spoken English is in some ways a slightly richer language than written English, because mm-hmm. you've got intonation and emotions and some of that sort. And that's part of the explanation. Although that then makes you wonder why we don't use audiobooks or YouTube videos instead.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, when I read the book, you're in the book. I see you in the book. When you're giving your thoughts, obviously, it's the same as the book. Very similar. However, the difference there is that this is a community experience. And I think for many listeners, this helps focus on the experience. Because we're all in it together. When one person has a question, we are all...